I'm John Kroll. Federal research indicates that suicide rates in the United States have climbed to a 30-year high. Today on No Limits, we're going to explore the why of this disturbing upward trend. And we will discuss ways that we might be able to help more people who are considering doing harm to themselves. My guests are Kimball Richardson, a licensed mental health counselor with Community Health Network, and Lynette Lewis with the National Alliance for Mental Illness Indianapolis. Please join this important conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits at WFYI.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. This is the last day of Mental Health Awareness Month, and we are going to talk about an important but in many cases disturbing subject, and that is suicide. Federal statistics show that suicides now are at a 30-year high in this country across all age groups, except for older Americans. If you'd like to join this important conversation, please call 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits at WFYI.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Kimball Richardson, who is a licensed mental health counselor with Community Health Network, and Lynette Lewis, who's chapter administrator for the National Alliance for Mental Illness, Indianapolis. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Certainly, and thank you both for being here to talk about, what is a really important subject. Well, we probably ought to start with, do we have any, let's start with, rather than the why these numbers might
sure.
be increasing, what the
That's
numbers,
a long conversation.
what the numbers are right now, what we're seeing in comparison to previous years. Kimball, I'll start with you.
Well, unfortunately, there is an increase in suicide around the country. Indiana has the second highest rate of suicide for youth, youth meaning ages 15 to 34. And we don't want that. Of course, we want to see that go down. Men, especially ages 34 to 65, also have a very high rate of suicide.
And, in terms of the numbers, is this how much higher is it, say, than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago? Do we have anything tracking on that?
We do. Do you have any Lynette, numbers to show, Lynette?
Lynette.
I was going to say up 24%.
Yeah, I thought it was just under 30.
Okay, so we're saying it's like,
significant.
Climbed almost a quarter since last year, or when was the last time that they tracked these numbers?
Well, we get this generally, of course, there's local statistics from the State Department of Health and Marin County Public Health Department, things like that. But also nationally, we track that through the Centers for Disease Control, things like that.
Okay. And let's start having that larger conversation now, because we're not going to get through it if we don't start it at some point.
Yep.
What is
exactly
the why of this? I mean, do we have an idea what factors, Lynette, might be leading to this disturbing spike?
I think the economy for a lot of people, job loss. I think you could probably help me out with this.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, there's I almost used the word the obvious, but it really isn't obvious. I almost said obviously depression.
Yeah.
But
mm-hmm.
let me just say this. Depression is not obvious for lots of folks in that not everybody thinks of certain symptoms as being associated with depression. There's still a stigma associated with certain mental health issues like depression, anxiety, et cetera. And recognizing that those illnesses are that. They're an illness. They're not a weakness. And so being able to say, I have these issues. I need some help. What I like to tell folks is, you might need just a little tune-up doesn't mean you need a major overhaul. Mm-hmm. Okay, a little tune-up, and that's okay. It's okay to – it doesn't mean you're weak or wrong or need to be ashamed or anything like that.
Where does this stigma – because we have talked we've done quite a few programs on mental wellness, mental health issues. And, you know, we keep circling back to this stigma because a lot of the problem is that the challenge is that people don't seek help, or in many cases they'll even resist help when it is offered. Where does that stigma spring from? I mean, is there any historic, because it, you know, you think about it, you're right, Kimball, Lynette, you wouldn't think if you broke your arm, oh, I'll just fix it myself.
Right.
Or I will just, you know, or I'll let it heal by itself and it'll be fine and everything will be fine. You would think, okay, I'm going to get somebody who knows how to do these things. Where does the stigma come from with mental health issues? I'll start with Lynette on that one, but I'd like to hear both of your thoughts.
I think oftentimes with mental illness, it's on the inside. We don't see it on the outside at all. Where we see a broken arm, we see somebody with a heart condition, that kind of thing. But with mental illness, it's, you know, going on in the brain, and we don't see the brain.
But I guess where I am with that, though, is, and Kimball alluded to this in one of his earlier comments, is this whole idea that, you know, it's either a defect of will or a character defect if you admit to being depressed or having some struggles. Where does that sense of moral judgment come from? That?
Well, let me just go back. And when you talk about the history,
yeah,
let's think about the history of our country as it started with the Europeans, okay? The issue of being willful, self-determined, you know, independent, that is awesome and it's great. But when it filters down to a mental health issue, just like Lynette said, we can't see it. And so it becomes an issue of it's not manly, you're being weak, you're not up to your game. And, you know, people, of course, then were suffering in silence. Literally, we can't see it, and so there's nothing that we could do about it.
How do you deal with that? I mean, because presumably in your professional lives, you have to deal with people who are in a lot of pain and yet are resistant to the kind of treatment that might help them deal with that pain. How do you cope with that, Lynette?
I think perseverance is a big one. Sometimes if a person, you know, is unwilling to accept treatment the first time, sometimes we go back a second, third, fourth, and just continue to hammer at it until it's just the right time for them to come in for treatment.
How do you structure the initial conversation when somebody says, I really don't need help, I'm fine, everything's cool? Kimball.
Well, what I like to do in a therapeutic way is in my mind tell myself, you know what, I might just be planting a seed because just like what Lynette said, it may take a few times for someone to really absorb the idea. Number one, I may have a problem. It may be something to do with my mind, my brain, my psyche, and I may need a little coaching or help to deal with that. And so sometimes I literally tell people, you know what you might want to think about? This might be the issue. You know, I just plant a little seed. Like, I know this is pretty, you know, I'm pretty 99% sure this is what's going on. But, hey, I don't say it to them like that. So I start out sometimes with a little bit more of a soft approach. There are a few times where I can be pretty confrontive with folks and hit it head on if needed, if I think that's the right thing. But generally – I try to let people come up with their own idea that, yes, this is the issue and I'd like some help for it.
We are talking about the importance of being aware of suicide because, you know, the number of federal research now shows that we are at a 30-year high in this country. If you would like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Adrian has done. Give us a call at 866-476-3881. Adrian, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
My name is Adrian. Thanks for having me on the program.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
I currently work for a mental health firm, and we have seen an interesting trend of individuals who were born and grew up in the 60s and 70s who have adverse opinions about mental health, especially suicide. I didn't know whether, A, you guys had seen that kind of behavior as well, and B, if you had, if you could explain a little bit of that.
When you say subversive, what do you mean by that?
They view mental health as kind of like, as you were talking about earlier, a form of weakness.
Okay.
Or it assumes that it automatically blankets you as some sort of derogatory term like crazy or mentally ill.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for calling the question. Kimball.
Adrian, you're talking about my peeps, okay? This is my age group. And I'm speaking anecdotally. I'm sure that there's research available on it. But, yeah, you're basically right. When I was growing up, mental health issues and problems simply were not discussed openly in a public setting. And you never – I never, probably until I got to college, literally in graduate school, heard the word suicide talked about. In fact, I remember in graduate school as a student, we had to practice saying the word suicide so we wouldn't stumble over it or feel uncomfortable with it when we were practicing working with clients. So unfortunately, I think he's right.
Well, if nobody talked about it, I'm sorry, this may take us a little bit. What led you to do the work you do then? What drew you into
it? John, that's a whole other program.
but I think it is part of, because at least some of it, and I, without giving too much away, I'm familiar with the demographic that he was referring to as well.
Right.
One of the welcome developments over time is that we are much more open, I think, as a culture in talking about all of this than we were 40, 50 years ago, or even 30 years ago. And we continue to be. I think some of that is because people have been encouraged to talk a little more about what they are dealing with. So I'm kind of curious, you guys were part of that wave that helped encourage. What drew you to that work? Lynette, you.
Well, unlike Kimball, I am not a trained mental health therapist, but I have worked with persons with disabilities nearly my whole adult life. So I just have gravitated to the helping professions. And I don't know, I think probably the most satisfying part of my job at NAMI Indianapolis is to have someone call me and need resources and perhaps be in tears when they first call. And then we talk about things, we give out resources, and then by the end of the conversation, there's no more crying and they feel like they've got some hope and some place to go. So that's what keeps me doing this kind of work.
Kimball.
Well, at one point in my life, I thought really, really wanted to be a professional football player. But if anybody knows me and can look at me, they're like, that's not going to happen, Kimball, okay?
Yeah.
But so what I did know that I could do pretty well was I just had a kind of an interest in people. I like detective work. I like to hear people's stories. I like to figure things out. And I was a pretty good listener. And so all those in combination drew me to psychology and the counseling field.
Was it difficult? I mean, you say that part of the training was to say suicide and over again so you wouldn't stumble and all of that. Was it difficult because these were not things generationally that we talked about a lot? Was it difficult to sort of wrap your head around? I mean, we're talking and working with subject areas that my life has not given me a whole lot of preparation to deal with.
Well, unfortunately, I had two high school friends die by suicide. And then, of course, being in the crisis intervention field, I knew some patients who died by suicide. And so it gave me, unfortunately, as a young man, a little bit closer understanding of the wake of despair that that person may have felt, but also that it leaves in the survivors.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about suicide. This is the last day of Mental Health Awareness Month, and federal statistics show that suicides are at a 30-year high in America across all age groups except older Americans. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on social media. My guests are Kimball Richardson with Community Health Network and Lynette Lewis with the National Alliance for Mental Illness, Indianapolis. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking today about suicide, trying to promote suicide awareness. This is the last day of Mental Health Awareness Month. And at this time, federal statistics show suicides at a 30-year high in America, and that's across all age groups, except for older Americans. My guests in the first segment indicated that actually Indiana ranks second in the category of youth suicides between the ages of 15 and 34 in the nation. My guests are Kimball Richardson, who is licensed mental health counselor with Community Health Network, and Lynette Lewis, who is the chapter administrator for the National Alliance for Mental Illness, Indianapolis. Wanted to ask, yes, Kimball.
John, can I just tweak just something
sure.
you said just a teeny bit?
Sure.
In that suicide is the second leading cause of death for youth in Indiana. I don't know that, period. I don't know that we are ranked second in the nation.
Oh, okay? I misheard
And
you
I may
then.
Have misspoke, so I want to apologize to you
oh,
for that.
Okay.
But we are, that's the second leading cause of death for youth
Although,
in Indiana.
Although, frankly, we have done shows on this this before, and at least that tracks with, I think, the research, the Kids Count Data Book,
yes,
Indiana
absolutely.
Youth Institute put together that showed that that we had a disturbing number. I think one in five of our young people have thought about, you know, killing themselves at one time.
I'm glad
or
you
another.
Mentioned that organization
yeah.
too, Indiana Youth Institute, because they are they're really important to us here in Indianapolis.
So I want to go back to the question though of why now, because it, obviously, you know, economic uncertainty has some factor, and you both kind of alluded to that, but by most measures, actually, the economy is in better shape than it was 6-7 years ago. One would think that the numbers, that would have been the time that it would peak if there were a direct correlation. So, you know, are there other factors that go into this besides, you know, economic concerns? Kimball.
Drug use. Heroin, especially opioid abuse. That's a huge topic right now. I would assume Lynette would agree with me
yes,
on
yeah.
that.
Absolutely.
And untreated depression. Those are the two biggies.
Okay. So in addition to the economic pressures and all of that, we're seeing the explosion, obviously, in drug use and then untreated depression. Gotten a question from a listener on Facebook, listener named Gary, regular listener. And if you'd like to reach out to us via Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. Says, I have a question about how many of the statistics include youth being treated or forced into treatment resulting in suicide. Do we have any numbers on that, Lynette or Kimball? Lynette.
I don't know of numbers on that at all myself, Kimball.
I don't know what he means, forced into treatment. I guess technically all youth are forced into treatment when they go to treatment because mm-hmm. their parents or somebody brings them there. I mean, I've been in the counseling profession for close to 30 years. Probably two teenagers in that time, and I've seen a lot of kids, have told me I really want to be in counseling. I can't wait to start counseling. I know this is really going to help me. I mean, basically everybody else says, I don't want to do this. I don't want to be here. So that's par for the course, really.
And all of that. So we don't have numbers on the folks. And I would think it would also be hard to draw a direct correlation, because if they're being pushed toward treatment, presumably there's a problem of some sort already.
Correct. Right. And we don't really know what treatment that was. You know, some forms of therapy are more, you know, indicated for certain problems than others. So we want to match the right treatment with the problem.
We are talking about suicide and suicide awareness here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Ron has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Ron, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
It's been my experience through the course of my life, which is getting longer now, that a lot of people, movie stars, whomever, people on the street, at some point in their lives go through thoughts of depression, and that may translate into thoughts of suicide, and manifested by drug abuse, being a cutter, being an alcoholic. And I was just curious as to if any studies have been done. What I have always suspected, that during those times in people's lives, there has been a chemical change in the body. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly. Good question, Ron. And I'm seeing nods of heads here, so we'll get you an answer.
Thank you.
Lynette, I'll throw that one to you first.
Definitely, I think that the chemical imbalance is a large concern, a large concern with, you know, all of these things put together.
And you know what we also saw is, interestingly, he mentioned celebrities. After Robin Williams died by suicide, there was a spike nationally in the number of suicides. So we know that, I think, you know, the thinking was, wow, if a celebrity who has basically everything monetarily, seemingly fame and everything at his fingertips to be happy can't be happy. Mm-hmm. Wow, there's no chance for me. There's no hope for me. And unfortunately, more people died by suicide in that aftermath of his death. Now, just the opposite of true, if there's a celebrity who comes out and says, yes, I've had a mental illness, or I've had depression, or I've had thoughts of suicide, I'm getting help, it's okay, there is hope and there is treatment, that has just the opposite effect, which it keeps people alive and gives people hope.
And we probably ought to talk here about a definition of what depression is. It's more than, you know, being upset or sad because something happened. Kimball, I'm going to throw that one to you. How do we define depression in clinical terms?
Well, in the United States, we use a manual. It's called the DSM. It stands for Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Illnesses. It's published by the American Psychiatric Association, and that's what almost all mental health professionals go by when you diagnose, if you will, depression. And depression is considered a mental illness that in large part encompasses feeling sad, or sometimes people will say blue, and having several other specific criteria and symptoms for a period more or less for 2 weeks or longer. So we're not talking about someone who gets down and you're down for a few days and then, you know, you kind of get back up and you're your regular self. This is specific symptoms and criteria that one has to meet for more often than not over a two-week period.
And it's different, obviously, than grieving or whatever, you know, there are times I think, okay, being a little bit depressed is actually a rational response to events. A loved one dies or whatever, you're not supposed to be happy for a little while.
Well, guess what? Feeling sad is normal.
Yeah.
It's a normal emotion. Now, most people out there listening, John, are going to say, well, duh, Kimball, who doesn't know that? Well, guess what? A lot of people don't know that. And a lot of very smart, accomplished people don't believe that it's okay to be sad or upset about things. And guess where those emotions go?
And they end up running away from them.
Boom. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Exactly.
I've gotten an email from a listener named Carol. If you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Can you discuss the concept of suicide being a contagious behavior? And do we mention this fact to someone we think may need help? Thank you. I'll start with Lynette on that one.
Okay. Kimball, I think you dealt with that and as far as the
celebrities.
The celebrities with the mm-hmm. contagious.
But you'll see it occasionally, like mm-hmm. in schools where
yes.
one kid you know, takes his or her own life and then a couple of others do it too. What accounts for that sort of the nature of that contagion? Is it a studied phenomenon?
Well, yes, it is. And that's why it's very important for schools. And I think, you know, of course, most schools do this, but have a plan, a crisis plan that includes having mental health professionals as consultants, maybe on as part of your school planning team, so that you know how to phrase the message if, in fact, there is a suicide, so that we don't have more in a short period of time. Yeah, there are certainly ways to deal with it.
We are talking about suicide and mental health here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what Carol has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Carol, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I have one question, because I've been doing some reading, but do any of the psychiatrists in Indiana use the functional MRIs or the SPECT scans, the single proton emission computed tomography scans, to look at a brain and see how it's working and help use that in their treatment plan? And also, if they are, is insurance covered?
Thanks very much for the call, Carol. I'm going to throw that one to Kimball because I only understood about half of what you said.
She used some fancy terms. I'm very impressed.
Thank you. Well,
I'm not a physician, but I do work in a hospital setting, of course, mm-hmm. and I am around a lot of psychiatrists. And I can tell you that some of what she's talking about is used by psychiatrists that are doing research. And some of those techniques are not generally made available to the public. They're not inexpensive. In other words, they're expensive, and they're not always well-defined and well-known in a general way, just like there's not kind of a mass blood test you can use to determine if you have a certain kind of mental illness.
How much at this stage right now, we've done several programs on this as well. There has really been an explosion in understanding of the way the brain works.
Yes.
And, you know, that's being used to, you know, create new curricula for schools and all sorts of things. How much of that is beginning to shape the way we deal with mental illness and begin to realize that even at some level, therapy is not necessarily the best approach? There could be, as Ron alluded to, a chemical imbalance in there that can be dealt with only through chemistry. Lynette or Kimball, either one of you. And since you're pointing,
we're looking
fingers,
at each other. She's pointing at me.
All right, yes, Kimball, we're going with you.
Well, I'll tell you, we are getting more technical, and there are some things that we are able to do with new kinds of technology, with brain stimulation and some other imagery kinds of techniques. But, you know, that's not a magic cure in and of itself. Everybody needs support, okay? Everybody needs human support and encouragement, even to remain compliant. Can you imagine, John, that some people, even though there are treatments available, they don't want to do it,
mm-hmm.
or they won't remain on schedule, or they don't want to do what their doctor tells them to do? Of course, I'm being a little facetious. The answer is yes, of course, that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why programs like NAMI, to have peer support and education and all those things, are so important. And that's why, you know, Lynette and I are friends and know each other, and our organizations partner and work very closely together for that reason.
Yes. At NAMI Indianapolis, we have a program called Family to Family. And in our Family to Family program, persons that are caregivers of those with mental illness take this 12-week course. And it's taught by two people that have taken the course themselves, then gone on to receive special training so that they can lead the course for others. But I believe one of the lessons just deals totally with the brain and how mental illness is seen in the brain. And it's probably the most complicated, I think, of all of the 12 weeks that our folks go through. But they have this nice manual and they can refer back to it. In addition to talking about the heavy stuff dealing with the brain, you know, they go into things like, how do I take care of myself so that I can be there for my loved one? You know, that's huge. So, yeah, we do have a lot of programs, and it is great to have someone like Kimball to work with. And
well, and organizations.
Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
I'm here representing Community Health Network and today, and so we partner with organizations such as the National Alliance for Mental Illness, Mental Health America, and all the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. All those kinds of programs are so beneficial.
Are there enough of them?
Well,
that's the other. I mean, that's the other theme that comes through in a lot of these discussions we have, is that, you know, there aren't enough resources.
Well, there aren't, unfortunately. Now, having said that, and I'll say this again when we come back maybe at some point and we talk about what can you do for, you know, what treatment resources are available. You cannot not get help in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me say that again. You cannot not get help in Indianapolis, in Indiana, or the United States. There are organizations that are available to you. And it's important that you reach out.
We are talking about suicide and depression here on No Limits. Karina, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I had a question. I had a loved one suffering from mental illness who was very resistant to getting any treatment or help, in denial. The whole family can see except for them. And so in trying to get help, we were often told that there's nothing we can do if the patient didn't voluntarily want to seek out help until they became a danger to themselves or others. And why is it that we have to sit around and wait for them to become a danger before we can get them some kind of help? Because with anything else, you can call an ambulance and they'll come right out and get them and get treatment. But with this, we have to wait until they commit a criminal act or something before they can get some help.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, and that is an issue we've discussed before, too. Kimball, I'll throw that one to you first.
That's lots of layers of answers. I want to go with the most intensive kind of situation first, and that is there is in Indiana and in every state of the nation, there are ways that people can be made to seek treatment, or at least to seek an initial evaluation, initial mental health evaluation. Typically, that falls in three categories. One, the person is dangerous to themselves and has a mental illness or an addiction. Two, the person is dangerous to others and has a mental health or addiction issue. And or the person is considered gravely disabled because of a mental health and or addiction issue. And that's where our training and program that we have with NAMI is called CIT training for law enforcement, which stands for Crisis Intervention Training. And the bottom line is you can call 911 if you believe someone needs a wellness check, someone is dangerous to self, others are gravely disabled, and an officer hopefully – and you can request that a CIT officer respond, and they can come in and based on their assessment make a determination if that person, even against their will, needs to be taken to the hospital for an evaluation.
But that's a difficult process for people.
Well, people have freedoms,
yeah.
Okay? And I know, and I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, hey, it is a high level. There's a high bar that we have to weigh between someone's personal right to decide, no, I'm not going to get help, even if I have a mental illness, and if we're considered it's a dangerous situation.
We are talking about suicide and suicide awareness here on No Limits. My guests are Kimball Richardson, who is with Community Health Network, and Lynette Lewis, who is with the National Alliance for Mental Illness, Indianapolis. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about suicide and depression. This is the last day of Mental Health Awareness Month, and at this time, federal statistics show that suicides are at a 30-year high in America, and that's across all age groups except older Americans. My guests are Kimball Richardson, who is a licensed mental health counselor with Community Health Network, and Lynette Lewis, who's the chapter administrator for the National Alliance for Mental Health or Mental Illness Indianapolis. We've gotten a question via Facebook from a listener named Michael, and if you'd like to reach out to us via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Michael says, is it still true that psychiatrists have a higher suicide rate than the general public?
There are some professions that do have very high suicide rates, like, very unfortunately, police officers. Mm-hmm. Our law enforcement brothers and sisters have an incredibly stressful job. Dentists, and I think maybe firefighters as well. Now, psychiatrists, I'm not sure about. Ironically, I don't know. I don't know that statistic. But
is there a correlation between depression and stress? Lynette.
I would say definitely. Yes, absolutely.
Guess what happens, or guess what could happen if someone doesn't attend to their stress? It can
cause depression.
There you go. It can lead to that.
Okay. And is that a chemical thing, or is it more, okay, I'm stressed. I don't think I'm ever going to get out of this mess, so I'm depressed because of that.
You know, I like to call it the full meal deal. I'm borrowing that phrase from another company. But
yeah,
that's what I mean is many people could benefit from medication and therapy together. Some people just do medication. Some people just do therapy. And it's the art and science of medicine that puts that together that helps people to get well.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And I don't want to forget that it's not just those two things, okay? It's support. It's sometimes people's family and friends, your religious affiliation. All those things are important factors in getting well.
We've gotten a question comment via Twitter. It says, and if you want to reach out to us on Twitter, you can find us at WFYI. It says, access to unsecured guns and ammunition are a huge risk factor for teen suicide. Gun use is the most lethal means of suicide, and all of that. I mean, do we make the means for killing ourselves much too easy to access in this country? I'll start with Lynette on that one.
I'm not really sure how I feel about this when there are lots of different layers and factors. With this, it seems like it is very easy to get a hold of guns.
I think a lot of it is it's education. Of course, there are most gun users are very responsible and educated folks about gun safety, but we just have to make sure that guns are safe. And any time we think someone may have an issue with depression or thoughts of suicide, guns, even apart from ammunition in a home, it's not a good combination. They have to go, even if it's temporary.
Absolutely.
Is there, and I should have asked this question like in the gun question, we lead the rest of the developed world by a huge margin when it comes to gun-related deaths. I mean, the rate is like 20-1. In terms of these numbers of suicides and the fact that we're spiking, are we seeing a similar trend around the rest of the world, or is this a particularly American phenomenon? Do we know, or have we seen the numbers?
My answer is I don't know if we know. We might. Certainly somebody's tracking that information. What I can tell you is if someone's depressed, why in the world would they be able to have access to to a gun or any kind of lethal weapon. You know, you just want to take, you just want to get that off the table, mm-hmm. and that's not a possibility. Now, that doesn't mean when someone recovers from depression that they can't go back to whatever kind of recreational use or hobby they have with guns. But when it gets to the point when someone's suicidal, let's not tempt fate or even have that as a possibility. Let's keep people safe.
I think the single best thing you could do for your loved one is to get that gun out of the house, even mm-hmm. if you're putting it in your car trunk, getting it totally away from it. So it's just out of the equation.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Catherine. You can find us on email at nolimits@wfyi.org. She says, please put suicide numbers in perspective. Are we talking 1 in 100 or 1 in 100,000? Kimball.
Does she mean nationally or for Indiana? Or
either one. We'll start with that. We'll start with nationally.
Oh, boy. I don't have that right in front of me. I'm terribly sorry. Well, I can tell you how suicide ranks.
Okay. I found this on the web for does she mean
yes.
national?
So,
pardon
so
me.
Go ahead. So possibly, I mentioned earlier, Catherine, the Indiana Youth Institute's Kids Count data book has some useful information, shows that in the survey there, 1 in 5 to 1 in 6 Indiana young people has thought about killing himself or herself, if that puts it now, the success rate, if you want to call it that.
Die by suicide.
Die by suicide. Whether they in fact do it, and still more have made plans.
I want to
go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that we have time, John, to get to the information on. Okay, we have the issue. We think someone's in trouble. Where can they go, and who do we call? And at some, you tell me when you're ready.
Well,
to
let's
talk
do
about
it
that.
Now. I mean, you've raised it. Let's do it, and we're going to do it also when we leave the show. That'll be the last word. I always like to leave on
very good
a note of some hope. But let's.
Well,
do
there
it
is
now
hope. There is help.
Yeah.
We want people to reach out. We want family and friends to call us if you have a concern. And when I say us, I mean the whole mental health community in central Indiana. It's not just Community Health Network. Of course, we're a part of Gallup Human Health Center. We do have a crisis line. I'll tell you what that number is in a second. But we also have partners, Midtown Mental Health Center, Aspire Indiana, Adult and Child Mental Health Center, Cummins Behavioral Health, NAMI, Mental Health America. All of these organizations, as well as American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, work together. Those of us in crisis intervention, those of us who do this work, know each other personally. And so we work very closely together to make sure that we're being good partners and making sure that we provide resources that can get people help.
Okay, let's give people the number, though.
Okay. There are several numbers. And I want to tell you about a text line and a couple of websites. Okay?
All of them. Yeah.
All right.
All of them. And so, I'm telling listeners now, get your pencil and paper out.
Here we go. So we'll say it more than once, of course. But, for example, there is a crisis line available at Community Health Network. It's 317-621-5700. 317-621-5700. Now, that is a line where you can get a live person. Initially, it is a phone tree because it serves several different purposes for our network. But if you choose option one, that's the crisis line, and you'll get a professional counselor. In addition, we have a partnership with Mental Health America of Greater Indianapolis to provide a text to help line, and that's 20121. If you text the words help now to 20121, a peer counselor will text you back.
Probably, I'll ask. I presume, because it's the kind of question that comes up, that these contacts will be treated confidentially.
Absolutely. Except in an emergency, we can call the police too if we need to. In order to save someone's life, we're going to do whatever we need to do to make that happen.
Life.
Absolutely.
Yes. We are talking about suicide and depression here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Phil, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. What's
on
your mind?
I just wanted to talk about two issues here within the suicidal. I've been suicidal 3 times. And in reference to the stigma of suicide, it shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone that there's a stigma to it. I've done a little bit of genealogy in my time, and way back in the 1850s, they were listing on the census chart someone who was mentally unstable as an idiot. And still today, we refer to people as being idiots or you ain't right. And so it shouldn't be any surprise to anyone that there's a stigma in it. And I think it'll go on for decades. The other issue I wanted to talk about was, how does a suicidal person think and how could they possibly think of taking their own life? And the reason they do that is that they think there's no other way out. Actually, this isn't a selfish issue. It isn't something they're taking away from others. They honestly feel, as irrational as the thoughts may be, that by getting rid of themselves, they will cure the problems, that they are the problem, not others, and they're doing something, brave as it might be, to help others eliminate this problem. And I'll let you go ahead and take it from there. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Lynette, you're looking at me, so I'm going to throw it to you first.
Well, I'm not exactly sure how to how to respond to that. There's a lot of layers to what Phil just said.
Well, and that is a common thing, though. I mean, I almost everyone, and this is one of the ironies, that we don't talk about it, but there are very few people walking around who's killed himself, and often that is sort of the mindset that they're not running, you know, they're not adding to the people who are left behind's problems. Somehow they think they're solving them by doing this.
People have what we call constricted thinking, and he's exactly right that they don't see any other option. But that's why there are peer support groups for survivors of suicide in the events a family or loved one has taken their life. In addition, there's another website I wanted to mention called www.havehope.com, havehope.com, and that's got lots of information on and some videos for how to get help yourself as well as how to encourage others to get help.
We've also we've gotten a couple of questions from listeners, one by email and one via Facebook, that deal with the same issue. Is there any correlation between early ADHD meds and suicide, drug use, depression in older kids?
That's a really interesting and good question. And what we find is people that have difficulty with impulse control sometimes make impulsive decisions. Obviously, that's not going to be a stretch to come to that conclusion. But for example, in addition to maybe some ADHD issues, and pardon my voice, I've got some allergies going on. In addition, anybody that has a drug or alcohol issue, of course, that lowers our threshold for impulse control. And so – and it makes it much more dangerous when we're talking about suicide. Those things in combination that we really want to pay attention to.
We've gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Amber. And if you'd like to find us on Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. Amber says, do you think the ubiquity of social media and its role in bullying has played a role in increased suicide rates? Conversely, do you think there is a role technology and social media can play in helping solve the problem? Lynette, I'll throw that one to you first.
Yes, I do think the social media is huge, especially you know, with teenagers and the increase rate with them.
The answer is yes and yes. I'm agreeing with everything that Lynette said. But the person that asked that or posed that comment is exactly right. It can be a detriment or it can be a help. We want to, of course, move toward how can we use technology to benefit people and to get them connected to the help they need and to keep people safe. Sometimes literally just checking in with people, even if it's a text message, how you doing? You know, keep it up. Make sure you go to your appointment. I'm here for you. I care about you. I'm thinking about you. all of those things can have a hugely positive effect on people.
Are there any, in these numbers, are there any signs of hope, any sense that we might be able to turn the corner on this? Kimball, I'll throw that one to you first.
Well, I'll tell you, if I knowing myself, okay, and if I know my friends and colleagues and professional partners out there, we're going to do it. We're going to make sure that these numbers go down, people get the help they need, and lives are being saved. It's that important to us. We feel that passionately about it. And I'm so thankful to you and to your program for allowing Lynette and I to be here today and to talk about this. I feel so strongly about it. We have to keep doing more, and we will. I promise you. We're gonna be there.
Well, this is a subject that it should be important to all people, but it is particularly, for reasons I won't go into, particularly important to the people who are associated with No Limits and
yes, sir.
And this program. I want to ask again, because I do want to, and we're getting close on time, to walk through. When we walk through the numbers before, places that people could call if they needed help. Is that the same? Are there support groups, though, for people who are watching loved ones wrestle with this? What is the approach if you are concerned about someone who is a family member or a friend or somebody? You know, how should you respond at that point, Lynette?
Well, NAMI Indianapolis has currently 11 support groups in the greater Indianapolis area. And all you would need to do is go to our website at namiindy.org, and all of our support groups are listed there. And they meet all over town, all different sides of town. Some are exclusive for persons with mental illness. Some are for the family and friends of those with mental illness. So
and can people just show up?
They can just show up.
They don't have to make a reservation.
They don't have to make a reservation at all. We offer all of our support groups and our education programs free of charge to the public. So it's kind of hard in this day and age to find something that is free of charge. But that's the one thing that I'm very proud of, that we can do that for people.
And I'll tell you what, we've got just a few seconds, Kimball. Let's toss out the phone number if someone does need help.
Right. 317-621-5700 is a crisis line. It's one of several crisis lines here in the city. But that happens to be associated with Community Health Network.
I'd like to thank you both for taking part in what is a very important conversation. I'd like to thank my guest, Kimball Richardson. He's with Community Health Network, and Lynette Lewis, who's with the National Alliance for Mental Illness, Indianapolis. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cherzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.